I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:49 p.m. on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. Present today are Representatives Hannon, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Jimmy, and the three co-chairs, Co-Chair Josephson, Co-Chair Foster, and Co-Chair Schrage. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah Lestufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We've been joined by Representative Galvin. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. And before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, the Department of Administration will present on the funding status of the Public Employees Retirement System and Teachers Retirement System. With us today from the Division of Retirement and Benefits are Kathy Lee, Director, and Christopher Noble, Chief Financial Officer. Also with us today and available to answer healthcare-related questions is Christopher Murray, Deputy Director. Director Lee and CFO Novel, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Lee. I am the Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And we are here today to present the funding status of the PERS and TERS. And I'll let Chris put himself on the record.
For the record, my name is Christopher Novo. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits and also with us.
For the record, my name is Chris Murray. I am the Acting Deputy Director of Health and Acting Chief Health Official for the Alaska Care Plans in the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
So we'll go to slide. Go ahead.
Okay. The PERS and TERS is organized amongst three different components. We have the Department of Revenue Treasury Division that handles the investments for the defined benefit plans and also helps determine the investments that members can, in the defined contribution plan, can put their funds into. They are staffed to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and they have both an internal and an external investment team. The Alaska Retirement Management Board is charged with the fiduciary duty over the investments. They set the contribution rates. They invest all the retirement system assets, including the health insurance. For retirees. They have an investment advisory committee to assist them, and they have a secondary actuary to review the primary actuary's assumptions and work in rate setting for the plans. The Department of Administration is where the Division of Retirement and Benefits lives. Our fiduciary is the commissioner, who is by statute the plan's sponsor. We administer the retirement benefits and the health benefits. We have the valuation actuary, the primary actuary. We hold that contract. And we have several third-party administrators that we work with for the retiree health plans and for record keeping. And we do audits of the employers to make sure that they understand how they're supposed to report salary and service information to us to help them be compliant. So.
Okay. Slide three.
So for the record again, it's Christopher Novell, CFO for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. At this point, I'd also like to say that available on the phone, we have David Kirshner, our principal actuary, with Gallagher, our actuarial consultants. And so David's going to be able to assist with questions relating to the actuarial position of our funds. So the planned format of our presentation is for me to spend some time speaking to PERS and TERS. Chris Murray will then spend some time on the health funds, and lastly, Director Kathy Lee will speak to the e-reporting outage, that occurred in November 24 and the restoration, which took us into July 2025.
Proceed.
So the first slide in this presentation is the membership as of June 30, 2025. As you can see, total there are 105,471 members. Active participants in PERS defined benefit versus deferred PERS deferred contribution plans are split 20-80%. The split with TERS is 25-75%. Defined benefits and defined contribution. We know that the defined benefit tiers closed to new enrollments in 2006. Therefore, we fully expect to see the membership split increase favorable to the defined contribution plan.
Okay. Slide four.
So slide four is speaks to the investment experience. The FY25 valuation is still in draft form to be officially submitted to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, the ARM Board, in March. The assumed actual earnings has remained at 7.25% since 2022 for PERS and TERS. Basing earnings on the fair or market value of assets for 2025, we see PERS and TERS at 10.8 and 10.9% respectively. The last row shows the actuarial valuation of the assets, which the draft valuation puts at 9.3% for PERS and TERS. This valuation uses a five-year smoothing method with the intent of eliminating any market volatility or extreme peaks and troughs. The assumptions here, the assumptions behind this data are reviewed every 4 years and discussed with and submitted to the ARM Board.
We have a question from Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Jessison, and through the Chair. Just really quick on slide three, I know that may be obvious to us here on the committee, but on your chart you show the DB tiers, tier 1, 2, 3 under PERS, tier 1, 2 under TERS, and then down below that we have is defined contribution DC plans, and just make sure that we're correct here, that is tier 4 under PERS and tier 3 under the TERS.
Through the Chair to Representative Bynum, that's absolutely correct, tier 4. For the defined contribution plans, and it's tier 3 for the TERS. Yeah.
I just wanted, through the Chair, wanted to make sure that that was clear for those that are watching. They may not have intuitively seen that because it is not on the slide that it says tier 4 and tier 3. So thank you.
Okay. Back to slide 4. Slide 5.
So slide 5 is when now we're looking at the funding status of our pensions. The PERS pension liability for 2025, again in draft form, stands at $17.3 billion, and the actuarial valuation of assets is at $12.2 billion. This leaves the PERS defined benefit of $5.1 billion unfunded, or 70.3% funded. As you can see, the same calculation using fair or market value of assets returns a similar funded amount of 71%. The TERS pension liability for 2025 stands at $8.1 billion, and the actuarial valuation of assets is $6.4 billion, which leaves the TERS benefit fund at $1.6 billion unfunded, or 79.8% funded. The pattern across the last 3 years shows both funds have increased their funded ratio each year.
That strikes me as certainly noteworthy and something to highlight. Those are substantial improvements. Is that right? The unfunded portions funded
the funded portion.
Yeah, the funded portion is growing rather remarkably, at least according to this.
To the chair, yes, there's been 3 years of year-on-year improvement on the funded ratio.
Okay, slide six.
Slide six speaks to the funded status of our healthcare funds. Here we have the opposite story. The negatives on lines C and F show the healthcare to be overfunded, with a funded ratio of 132.1% actuarial valuation assets, or 133.5% FVA on PERS. TERS is showing an AVA of 140.6 and an FVA of 142.2%.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the Chair. Really quick, when we're looking at the health care funding, I think some folks might look at this and wonder why in the health care component we're seeing this funding ratio of 130%, but when we go look at the actual defined benefit portion, that we're seeing a funding ratio of around 70%. Can you briefly just tell us a little bit about why that's actually happening? Because both of, if I'm not mistaken, both of these things actually kind of were part of the same timeline and when they were implemented. So I'm just hoping you might be able to point out that there's a distinct difference in why one is performing very well according on paper and the other one is not historically performed well.
So through the chair to Representative Bynum, I'll give you one reason. I might hand off to my colleagues. The main reason is the EGWIB subsidy, which was granted to Alaska in 2019. And we're going to have a chart a little bit later which shows that the overfunded status for both PERS and TERS does coincide with that year and EGWIP.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's proceed.
So the graph on slide seven, and this shows the funding status for PERS, pension and healthcare. I'm going to stress at this point the pension and healthcare funds are completely separate and may not be used to offset each other. So this side-by-side chart is for visual information purposes only. So proceeding with that caveat, the chart shows pension in blue and healthcare in orange. And you can see as the PERS pension is below the 80% mark, whereas healthcare is over 130%, consistent with the data presented on prior slides. And also, to Representative Bynum's question, you can see that around about 2018, healthcare moved into overfunded status.
Okay. Slide eight.
Slide eight shows TERS telling the same story as PERS, an overfunded healthcare fund and an underfunded pension fund.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Novell, does any of that healthcare growth, is it indicative of all pension health plans as your retirees move to Medicare eligibility, right? There's the pension benefit for I'm a TERS retiree. That's always on the state, but I've recently moved to the Medicare, so I assume that I am less burdened on the health care retiree because Medicare first. Is that impacted as our retirees have aged into that demographic and as our later tiers get closer to people? I was able to retire at 55, but many of the Tier 3 can't retire till they're 65, so they immediately, as a retiree, are primarily Medicare before they're drawing on the health trust.
Mr. Murray, you want to respond to that? Or
certainly. For the record, my name is Chris Murray. I am the Acting Chief Health Official and Deputy Director of Health with the Alaska Division of Retirement and Benefits, through the chair to Representative Hannon. The answer to your question is yes, and to sort of expound a little bit on what you were speaking to. When our retirees become Medicare age eligible, Alaska statute requires that the plan pay supplemental to Medicare. And so as the retiree population, and as you know, the retiree population is aging, the DB retirees are starting to age, and year over year we've seen a significant increase in the number of retirees who are Medicare age eligible. I believe, and I'd be happy to go look at exact, but I believe last I heard it was about 80% of our DB retirees, and so we're seeing more and more, and now we are starting to see what we've sort of reached that peak, and so we are now starting to kind of level off and perhaps even decline a little bit as we go through the years for the DB retirees. And so you are correct. There is a lower burden on the Alaska Care Retiree Health Care Trust and plans for retirees who are Medicare age eligible and Medicare pays primary. However, it is a much less significant contributor to the overfunded status of the plans than that egg whip that my colleague mentioned that was implemented back in 2018 in one fell swoop that reduced the liability by about $1 billion. And so, as you can see in the charts, the overfunded status of the health care trust continues to go up and up, and while the situation that you mentioned certainly contributes to it to a small degree, not nearly to the degree that the implementation of the egg whip plan did.
Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
Could you remind us of the egg whip? Thank you, through the chair. The egg whip plan, what it is, and is it an annual or was it a one-time $1 billion infusion?
Certainly. Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I'm happy to speak to that now. We do have slides on it later in the presentation. If you'd like, it's entirely up to you.
Why don't we wait? Okay. All right. We were at slide 9, or were you done with 8? 9.
For the record, Chris Novell, CFO, Retirement and Benefits. Slide 9 shows the correlation between the actual rate of return and the funded ratio for our pension only. For your viewing ease, the percentages in bold show a change in the assumed actual earnings rate. Since 2000, our assumed actual earning rates has been changed on three occasions, most recently in 2022 to 7.25. The 30-year average is shown on the last line. In analyzing this data, it's important to consider the impact of the $3 billion infusion in 2015 when looking at that funded ratio.
We have a question from Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Drew Justin, through the chair. Thanks, guys, for being here. I'm curious on a couple of things. So in this slide, we're looking at our actuary funded ratio with our assumed rate of return versus our realized, but we're not looking at our actual projected liabilities and how they have changed over time. So I'm curious why we would not want to show the committee, when we talk about the funded status of these plans, how many times we've actually had or actually change our accrued liability projections as opposed to our rate of return projections. Through the chair.
Mr. Novell.
So, through the chair to Representative Stapp, we can certainly provide that information to your office for a side-by-side comparison of the unfunded liability against these lines.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. So just to be very specific, so we mentioned that our assumed rate of return has been ratcheted down on three occasions, right? What I find is more interesting on our projections on the plan is how our total liabilities have actually doubled on a projected basis in the last 20 years, right? And to me, I've never really understood how on a closed plan, projected liabilities, not just the funded and unfunded status, but total liabilities have increased so dramatically on a closed plan. And I'm curious if you guys know kind of what the driving factor behind that metric is, and it would be nice to show it on a slide through the chair.
Mr. Novell.
So through the chair to Representative Stapp, I do have David Kirshner on the line, so I could defer that question to him. He might be answer more succinctly than I.
Well, just getting a sense of where we are, and I think we can tolerate that sort of pivot. Mr. Kirshner, are you with us, sir?
Yes, hello, can you hear me?
We can. Did you hear the question from Representative Stapp?
Yes, I believe the question was, we've shown here on slide 9 the changes in the investment, assumed investment rate, and why have the liabilities increased considerably over the years. I believe that was the question.
Yeah, through the chair to Mr. Kirshner. Close enough. I'll do a follow-up if Penny. Thanks.
Okay. Yes, that was the question. Mr. Kirshner, do you have an answer for us?
Yes, through the chair. Representative, the assumed investment return rate is one element that we use to measure the value of future benefits, which is the liability, the present value of those future benefits. Every 4 years, the Alaska statutes require us to conduct what we call an experience study, which means every 4 years we reevaluate all of the assumptions, not just the assumed earnings rate, but we update the assumptions as regards to how long people are expected to live, when they're expected to retire, what rate salaries are expected to increase over time, et cetera. And every time we do those experience studies, we have a resulting increase in the liabilities due to all of the assumption changes, not just the assumed investment rate. The other thing that comes into play is the actual experience of the plan. Until the most recent year, we've had a series of years where we've been in a very high inflation environment, which means the post-retirement pension adjustments, which are the CPI-linked cost of living increases that retirees get under both PERS and PERS, those increases have been considerably higher than what we were projecting them to be based on our inflation assumption. Also, the last few years, we've had considerably larger increases in salaries, particularly for the PERS, peace officers, and firefighters, and that has contributed to larger liabilities than we expect. So it's a combination of all of those factors that have caused the pension liabilities to increase more rapidly. And then on the flip side, we've seen the healthcare liabilities, in addition to the significant reduction due to the adoption of EGWP, the implementation of EGWP back in 2018, we've also seen a few successive years where the actual claims paid by the plan have been less than what we've assumed, although we've seen in the last couple of years, we've seen an actual turnaround in that where claims are higher. So every year it's a series of moving parts that all contribute to the effects that you're describing.
One quick clarification, Mr. Kocher.
Clarification, Representative Stapp.
Yep, thank you, Kocher. Justin, through the chair. Thanks for the very detailed answer. So just to clarify, basically, regarding the increases in total liabilities, every time we've done the experience study, the projected liabilities of the plan have been more than we assumed. Correct, through the chair?
Mr. Kirshner.
Yes, through the chair, yes, that's true. That's the last few years, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirshner, it's Chair Josephson here. Recently, a national group challenging reform of the pension system claimed that since 2001, Alaska's pension plans have earned just 5.8% in annual returns on average. Is that consistent with your knowledge and with slide 9?
Chair Josephson, I am not aware of that statistic. As you can see, based on these calculations, the average return over these years has been about 7.6. We also have historical rates, market rates in our valuation reports, and according to our calculations, from 2005 to 2025. The cumulative market return for both PERS and TERS has been about 7.1%.
Okay.
So I'm not sure where that statistic that you referenced was coming from.
All right. Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Just as a point of record for the committee, is it possible that we could be shared with that specific information you're referencing so that outside of this we'd be able to have a better understanding of what the question is related to? And then secondly, if
the answer is yes, we'll find it and distribute it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, if the members testifying, we're going to provide some additional information to Representative Stapp. If that could be made available to the full committee, that'd be much appreciated.
Yes. Did Representative Stapp ask for follow-up information?
Chair Justin, I just asked them basically to plot out, to be able to provide for the committee the things that Mr. Kirshner articulated that are kind of left out of the slide deck. So we have one lever that on the assumptive rate of return change, they're not reflecting the other levers that go into the cost basis.
And we're happy to see Representative Sadler with us here. I think we're through with slide 9. Okay. We'll move to slide 10.
So slide 10 is related to slide 7. This shows the unfunded actuarial liability in dollars rather than as a percentage of funded ratio since 2006. Pension fund is in blue. The healthcare is in orange. Underwater is overfunded. And as you can see, from 2018 onwards, healthcare moved from being under to overfunded.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And just a brief point of this slide. I know that we had talked about 2018 being the year that we saw this influx of funding for the healthcare component. But if we actually go back and we look at the trend from 2010 and forward, that amount continued to decline. And then had been hovering around that neutral point starting in 2015. Is it expected that that trend would have continued without the influx of additional dollars in 2018?
Mr. Neville.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum.
Well.
I'm going to have to follow up with that and get a deeper dive on my data.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. Slide 11.
So slide 11 is telling the same story with the TERS retirement system, with healthcare being mostly overfunded since 2015, the same as, 3 years earlier than PERS.
Okay. Slide 12.
So slide 12 shows a history of legislative bills towards the additional state contributions from 2006 to 2026, including the $3 billion infusion into the plans in 2015 under House Bill 119.
Mr. Novell, could you, in the simplest manner, describe why the governor's budget has about $35 million less for the last column, that is the state contribution, than the ARM board is recommending?
To the chair, the division wasn't involved in discussions related to the budgeted additional state contribution, so we'd have to refer that question back to the ARM board.
Okay.
Or OMB.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I think that is a great question, Mr. Co-Chair, because it's something I've been wondering as well. And I was wondering if at some point, maybe not right now, that we could get some direction from the professionals that are looking at this on a recommendation I believe that maybe from our perspective, this is something that we should be funding and, you know, fully funding and at the recommendation of the ARM board as opposed to underfunding it. And if there was a thought on that and what the long-term impact might be, it would be nice to know.
I'm going to have my staff take note of that request.
Thank you.
Let's go to slide 13.
Sorry, I apologize. Slide 13, we have a projection of the additional state contributions for 2027 through to 2039.
Okay. Slide 14.
So the purpose of this slide is to demonstrate the difference in additional state contributions and state as employer contributions with the inclusion and omission of the health plan normal cost. The difference is 63.8 million. In recent years, the healthcare normal cost is set at zero, and this is influenced by the health plans being overfunded.
Representative Hannon for Mr. Novell.
Mr. Novell, I want to go back to slide 13 real briefly. Through the chair, thank you. 2039 PERS, the additional state contributions projected to be zero. Is that because you're anticipating we are fully paid off in 2039?
Through the chair to Representative Hannum, this is based on an amortization that is yet to be finalized by the ARM board and their actuaries, but this runs by the assumptions that it will be 100% funded by 2039.
Follow up,
Representative Hannon for Mr. Novell.
And is there a reason we don't anticipate that the TERS system that is currently at a higher percentage of funded wouldn't also be fully funded by then?
Mr. Novell.
Through the chair to Representative Hannum, with this scenario, the PERS would be fully paid off in 2038 and there'll be zero to pay in 2039, whereas TERS' final payment of 81 million would mean that it would be fully paid off and amortized by 2039, if I explain that.
Follow up?
Yes,
just because I. So if they're both. So it would show a zero in 2040 under the TERS system? Okay.
Mr. Novell.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, correct.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Mr. Novell. That's assuming that our current assumptions actually bear true, because if I were to ask you, if the liabilities we had projected on the plan 10 years ago were accurate, would we have been paid through this debt already? Yes or no? I'm fairly certain the answer would have been yes, if that's correct, through the chair.
Mr. Novell, and if you're not satisfied with the yes or no, we will take the essay answer.
Yeah.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, could you yeah. repeat it?
Yeah. Through the chair to Mr. Novell, yeah. I'll try to summarize it. I said this is assuming our assumptions are true, because if I were to go to 2014 and I were to look at the total funded valuation of the assets of the plan compared to the total liabilities projected in 2014, I'm fairly certain the plan would be paid off already if the liabilities we were projecting actually came to fruition, through the chair.
Mr. Novell.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, that's a fair assumption.
Thanks.
Okay. Slide 14 or 15, your preference. 15.
So, slide 15. This shows the actuarial projections of the funded level of healthcare trusts over the next 14 years, with the normal healthcare cost contributed, and without the normal healthcare cost contributed.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And I never thought to ask this question. I probably should have asked it well before now. But this fund is protected. We can't move these these dollars away from the healthcare trust. What is going to happen with this when there are no more participants partaking in the benefit?
Mr. Novell.
Kathy Lee, Director of Division of Retirement and Benefits. Because these health funds also serve the defined contribution funds, there is an option if you no longer have anyone in your fund but you have a similar fund, that there can be some movement there. But we're looking over the lifetime of a member and their survivor. So when the last DB person retires, then that is at least 40 to 60 years from then before, you know, they might pass away. So it's very difficult to project forward exactly what the balances in these accounts will be, because what we're seeing here is also looking at the EGWP plan. That's a federal plan. It's not guaranteed. It could stop at any time. And at that point, our funding for the health plans will start to regress. And the last I heard, it would be 6 to 12 years before we're down to 100%. Okay. But they will continue to trend downwards, possibly after that, depending on claims and how long people are living. So it's very hard to give a specific answer.
Perfect.
To that.
Thank you very much. So it's complicated.
Complicated.
All right.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Remind me, we're continuing to take contributions for people into a fund that's overfunded, and on this page, we are looking at growth to 220% overfunded in the TERS health plan. I understand being conservative and making sure we have enough money to serve the beneficiaries that we do, but at some point it seems like we're taking money to invest in something that it's perhaps not the best use of those dollars in perpetuity. Is the ARM board recommending zero contributions from members, or we're just planning for a rainy day when the Fed goes away and we all live to be 150 and I'll be very expensive by then?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, these are employer costs, so we're not taking this from employees, but there is the thinking of no further contributions are needed because for a time at least, because the funds are overfunded.
Follow-up, Representative Hannon, for Ms. Lee, who's
thank speaking. You. And I probably should have, thank you through the chair, when I said members, I do mean the employers, and all of our employer groups from school districts, municipalities are struggling financially, but we're continuing to ask them to contribute to a fund that's overfunded. Is the ARM board recommending that we take a brief timeout from continuing to fund at the rate we are, or reducing it, ratcheting it very far down? Because in the end, that would give them some short-term economic relief and seem to not harm the beneficiaries that we are obligated to.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's what this slide actually shows, is what the effect would be if there are no more normal contributions taken. And as you can see, the trend still is to increase. So I can't speak for the ARM board, but I know this is something that they're looking at. They are also looking at potentially, they've passed a couple resolutions to expand benefits as well.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Lee. So I had, with our Legislative Finance Division, we'll run these numbers back, much further. And I would point out that is recently as FY21, the healthcare portion in PERS was funded 142.7%. So obviously, 5 years later, we are less than that, still overfunded, but 131%. So I'm curious how you would consider this is not modeling normal costs, so without normal cost contribution, how you could still model linear growth in funded status without normal contributions. Through the chair.
Ms. Lee.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. These figures are based on assumptions that we know today and potential trends. These are the numbers that the actuaries have come up with. Claim experience will change them. We have had one $12 million claim in the employee plan in the last year. And as the price of pharmaceuticals as well as medical treatments, new medical treatments and pharmaceuticals come out, those are very expensive, and those will also affect this ratio. So this is based on what we know today.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up for Representative Stapp, yeah. For Ms. Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Ms. Lee. So, I completely agree with you. I mean, they are based on large claims, pharmaceutical experience, really plan experience to plan. If I were to go back to, say, FY13, when we were in big trouble in the healthcare, our projected liability was $2.2 billion. The concern I have is without normal contribution to the plan, we have a chart in front of us that says valuation is going to continue to increase exponentially. And we know that's not the case even with recent experience in the plan. Like if I go back to FY21, it's 141%, then it trended downward because of those plan adverse experience. So the reason I want to put that on the record is I don't want people on this committee to think that just because I'm looking at a paper that says number go up, that's actually what's going to happen. Because as I had Mr. Kirshner mention earlier, every single time we've done an experience study on the pension portion of our plan, it has been wrong one way. And that's always the way that says the state owns more money. And the expectation that the healthcare portion is going to continue to be overfunded, even if we make no contributions, is probably incredibly unrealistic. Thank you.
Okay, no question there. So we'll go to slide 16.
Slide 16 shows the FY27 contribution rates for the defined benefit plans and how they're calculated at to arrive at the total actuarial required contributions, employer and employee. So firstly, we take the employee rates of the peace and fire officer, then all other employees, and then the school district, alternate option, and TERS employees. Then we take the employer rates, which are capped by statute, at 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS, plus the additional state contributions, which include the DCR contribution, which is 5.5% for PERS and 20.58% for TERS.
Okay. Slide 17.
And slide 17 shows the FY27 defined contribution tier 4 rates. 8% of gross is paid by the employee with an employer match of 5% for PERS and 7% for TERS. All the employer contribution rates are added, and the difference between that and the 22% for PERS and the 12.56% for TERS goes towards the defined benefit plan's unfunded liability.
Slide 18
is showing the difference between the statutory rates for PERS and TERS and the actuarially determined rate. The spread between the blue and orange lines is the portion covered by additional state contributions.
Slide 19.
Slide 19 is showing the projected benefit recipients up until 2053. As more people retire, the pension recipients are forecasted to rise to a peak for PERS in 2030 and TERS in 2031. As is currently the case, will employees join the defined contribution tier four? So defined benefit recipients will become less in number.
Yes, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And through the chair, really quick, we showed on slides 16, 17, and then we have some projections on 8 or cost on 18. Do you actually have the side-by-side comparison, historical side-by-side comparison cost for what the state and employers are paying specifically when we compare side-by-side defined benefit plan full cost, including the 22% cap and then the state share versus what the employer is paying for the DC plan and then up to that 22% cap that then also pays for previous DB. Do you have basically a similar chart to 18 that would show those comparisons?
Mr. Neville.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I can certainly get that data to you in a chart form.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to, are we at 19 or 20?
I have 20.
Okay. Yep.
Slide 20 is showing a similar story to the prior slide, but in a monetary way and relating to benefit payments. TERS will peak with $686 million in benefit payments in 2033 and PERS with $1.5 billion in 2038. Gradually, of course, recipient dollars will reduce to a near zero at the end of this century.
Okay. Slide 21.
So for the next slide, I'm going to hand over to Chris Murray, our Acting Chief Health Administrator.
Murray, slide 21.
Thank you. For the record, Chris Murray, Alaska Division of Retirement and Benefits. So slide 21 is describing the EGWIT plan or the Employer Group Waiver Plan. And so essentially what this plan is this is a group Medicare Part D plan. So just as anyone who is Medicare age eligible can go out and purchase their own Medicare Part D plans, this is a plan that is purchased by an employer, by a group. And all of our retirees, for the most part, are enrolled in this particular plan. Now, this plan, what it does is it provides direct subsidies. The EGWIP program, which is run through CMS, provides direct subsidies to the plan on a monthly basis. And these subsidies do change from year to year. I believe that Director Lee earlier was speaking. She said that, you know, there's certainly no guarantee that these will continue. There is a slide later on. But when this plan was implemented back in 2018, essentially what it did is it reduced liabilities in the retiree health care plans by nearly $1 billion. And you can see that figure there, which is $959 million. So to Representative Hannon's earlier question, it was not an injection necessarily. It was just a reduction in future liabilities for the retiree health care plans and specifically pharmacy costs, because this is a Medicare Part D is a pharmacy plan. So that is what the EGWIP plan is. Then slide 22 speaks to the subsidies that I was describing. And so there are a couple of different types of subsidies that an EGWIT plan provides. There are direct subsidies, and those typically come on a monthly basis. There is a catastrophic reinsurance. This is a reinsurance program that is that is designed to help with very high-cost medications. There are various other subsidies, but as you can see throughout the years, you know, in 2021, from $64 million up to in 2025, $107 million in subsidies. Now, the one thing that I do want to point out is that you'll note that in the earlier years, The direct subsidies were negative, and then the catastrophic reinsurance was significantly higher due to the Inflation Reduction Act. Some changes in the calculation of these subsidy payments was made, and so as you can see, the direct subsidies have gotten significantly higher. The catastrophic reinsurance got lower, and so the CMS or the federal government is paying less of that, but they are paying more in direct subsidies. However, there's certainly no guarantee that this will continue, and as you can see, these formulas and the amount that we receive in subsidies does change from year to year. It just happens to have worked out in our favor up to this point.
Representative Stapp, then Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Justin, through the chair. So let's say CMS comes out and tomorrow and they say we're not going to do IGWIP anymore. What does that do to the projected liabilities for our plan and therefore the funding status to the health care portion of the plan? Through the chair.
Mr. Murray.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. While I do not have specific numbers, it would be a significant blow to the funding status of the plan. As we mentioned, the primary reason for the overfunding starting in 2018 and moving through current is due to these EGWIP subsidies. That would be a question that I'd have to take to our actuarial consultants to be able to give you specific numbers. But I think it's fair to say that it would have a significant blow to the to the health of the plans.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Cook.
Follow-up, Representative Stapp.
It'd be super helpful. I don't need a perfect number here through the chair, but it would be nice to know if CMS rug pulls this, are we back to less than 100% funded status, for example? That would be...
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, we'd be happy to provide that.
Thank you.
Please provide it through the chair and as you do so.
Certainly.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Does the EGWIP program, is every state's public pension programs participating or are eligible to participate in the EGWIP subsidies?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I'm sorry, I don't have the direct answer to that question. I do know that there are some states that do participate in it. There are other states that do not. As in regards to the eligibility and whether or not all states are, able to, I can't speak specifically to that, but I would be happy to track down the answer of that question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph. And I'd like us to know that so that we have an understanding of whether we're one of 10 benefiting or all 50 states have pressured Congress to continue to do this because pharmaceutical costs have driven up health care. And then I have a follow-up on a slightly on the same topic, but...
No, yes, but I like your question because political pressure is a powerful thing. I mean, we could end Social Security also, couldn't we?
Right.
But
right.
Representative Hannon?
And then just making sure that on chart 22, these are calendar years, so I'm looking at the catastrophic reinsurance for 25 being such a drastic reduction, and I assume that you've got a footnote that says because we've got a true up. And I guess in my mind, the catastrophic reinsurance for drugs are probably cancer treatments and oncology, and not that we've had a dramatic downturn in the number of beneficiaries or people suffering from those kinds of needs, but the bills just haven't come in because we're on the 1st of February and the lag time for being billed for that, but that subsidy matches what we've had to pay out.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, what you're seeing there is, and I touched on it briefly earlier, is a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. Essentially what the federal government did is they changed the formula that essentially the direct subsidies were increased and the catastrophic reinsurance was decreased. The intent there is to put the management of these high-cost drugs more, basically to incentivize plans to better manage high-cost drugs, and it sort of takes the liability off of the federal government and puts it more onto the particular plans. And so what you're seeing there is in 2025, they increased significantly the direct subsidies and decreased the catastrophic reinsurance reimbursement.
Representative Hannon.
On that issue, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Will we be able to meet the needs of the Alaskans who need this catastrophic reinsurance? Are we making the payments to make sure they continue their medical treatments that are horrific, over the top, and are we able to pay those bills?
Mr. Murray.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon. The retiree health benefits on the DB plan are quite robust. And in terms of the medications right now, our retirees are paying either a $0 premium, a $4 premium, or an $8 premium for a medication that could cost tens to even hundreds of thousands of dollars. Currently, the retiree health group health and health trust funds are overfunded. And so, you know, it certainly looks good right now. But, you know, as we say, you know, we're hesitant to say yes because we have no idea what could happen tomorrow. One of the next slides, as you can see, it does show healthcare trends and pharmacy trends. They do increase year over year. You know, the state of Alaska, care is very expensive. And so, you know, it is one of those things that, as the projections show currently, it's looking good, but we are constantly reassessing those. You know, we are constantly looking for ways to manage that cost in order to ensure that it is available.
Representative Bynum, and then Allard.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And through the chair, the specifics of the employer group waiver plan, my understanding is that's an opt-in program that's offered to all states. Whether a state participates or not, that's up to them. Is this a guaranteed benefit that we're required to provide, meaning that if for some reason the plan were to be is this something that could be opted out of by the state, or is this a guaranteed benefit?
Mr. Murray.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I'm sorry, I do not know the answer to that question. I'd be happy to track that down and see if I could find that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, could you had stated that it's overfunded, but we never know what's going to happen in the market. Can you tell me how much it's overfunded by? Is it on here?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I believe that there was an earlier slide. I'm just looking back through my slide deck. So if you go back to slide 15,
yep.
As you can see that as of 2026, PERS is overfunded to 131%, and TERS is overfunded to 140%.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, through the chair. So a couple questions. Just a quick one on our catastrophic reinsurance. What amount of claim loss until our reinsurance kicked in? Through the chair.
Mr. Murray.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. I would have to go back and look at those specific because, like I said, as you mentioned, it is a percentage, and it was recently changed. I would like to go back and make sure that I'm giving you correct numbers to say that, you know, once it reaches this particular number or this particular percent, that's when the catastrophic reinsurance kicks in.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Justin, through the chair. Yeah, thanks. I mentioned this because the director said a little bit ago that you've already had a $12 million claim, so that's clearly going to hit the catastrophic reinsurance kind of portion of that. I'm curious, what are the ramifications here if you absorb claim valuation above the reinsurance numbers paid for on the ECWIP? Because obviously 15.71 million is relatively close to 12 million. So if you have a couple more catastrophic claims, I assume we are on the hook for that, obviously, because we're the insurer. Because our reinsurance has got to cap out at something, I'd imagine, through the chair.
Mr. Murray.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. Yes, you are correct. A point of clarification, if I may. The $13 million claimant was on the employee plan, so it was not on the retiree plan, so it would not have applied to what we're discussing here today. You know, with the increased cost of these drugs, with these genetic treatments that are paid through the pharmacy plan, and with the low amount of cost shares that our defined benefit retirees are paying, again, $0, $4, and $8. A fair amount is covered by CMS, but it has been certainly decreased in recent years. And so the answer to your question is yes, that would essentially fall upon the retiree health plan to be able to pick up the rest of that. But once again, you know, when we're looking at current projections and, you know, they take into account as much as they are able to and what is known, they are still projecting that the plans will remain overfunded, you know, notwithstanding some sort of, you know, disastrous change in either CMS or in the EGWIP program that we're just unable to foresee.
And last follow-up, Mr. Kutcher.
Last follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Kutcher, Justin, to the chair. If you could quantify this, it would be a great, so simple, you know, at some point, maybe it would be just nice to know how many catastrophic claims it would take to make a material impact on the funded status of the plan, if that makes sense, through the chair.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, be happy to talk to our consultants and see if we could get that information for you and be happy to provide that to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Right, let's go to slide 23.
And then slide 23, this is speaking to the healthcare cost trend rates that I alluded to earlier. As you can see here, they are projected to increase every single year between 6.5%. You'll notice that the prescription rates under the RX EGWIP column in 2026 and 2027 are projected to increase by 8.5% and 8.2%, going down to 4.5%. But once again, as you can see, this chart just goes up. It does not go down. And, you know, there's certainly no expectation that at this point healthcare will get any less expensive.
Okay. Slide 24.
Back on the record, Christopher Novell, CFO, Division of Retirement and Benefits. So slide 24 here shows the process timeline from valuation to on board resolution on additional state contributions to pay down our unfunded liability for PERS. In March, we are conducting our four-year experience study. So an experience study is conducted every 4 years, and it reassesses the demographics, economic assumptions, and payroll assumptions. And there are no questions. That concludes my part of the presentation.
Okay.
And I hand over to Director Lee for the next few slides.
Director Lee, why don't you take us home here?
Okay, Kathy Lee, Director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. This is just a short update on a appropriation that we got approved last year. So on November 4th, 2024, we were notified by the State Security Office that we had an attempted intrusion into our systems. And so our systems were all shut down while a security investigation occurred. The security investigation showed that there was no breach of our information, so we were quite grateful about that. However, the suggestion was that we move our systems to the state cloud to provide additional protections to this information, which we did. When we did, though, we discovered that our employer reporting tool was not compatible with the cloud and needed some reprogramming. So we were unable to accept employer contribution reporting from November 4th to about February 6th. In that intervening time, we did develop a manual process, so we were processing some employer contributions, but it was very laborious and took quite a while. So e-reporting came back online on April 9th, and from that point, we had to have a three-phased process in order to post all of the back contribution reports, because in our system, we have to report them in date order. So it took a while to get all of them collected and posted, and we're very grateful for the cooperation we received from our employers in getting these caught up. But because we weren't posting the contributions timely into the defined contribution members account, there was an assumed loss of any gains or losses to their accounts for that intervening time. The federal government requires us to make that good and make them whole. So we requested an appropriation based on an estimate of what we thought that amount would be, which was $2.6 million. And that was our best estimate at the time. We used the U.S. Department of Labor Voluntary Fiduciary Program, Correction Program, which is an online calculator. So as we sent in the contributions that we were processing, our partner and record keeper Empower calculated the gains or losses and posted those to the participant's account and notified us of the amount periodically so we could transfer the money to them. The total amount we paid out was $1.3 million. $692,000 of that was to PERS, $552,000 of that was to TERS, and $64,000 was to SBS. At this point, all of our employers have caught up on their contributions except for one. And we are still working with them to get those contributions processed. So we have a remaining balance of $1.3 million, which on June 30th, 2026, we will be returning to the state.
Okay. Doesn't happen very much.
Let's go to slide 27.
Yeah, this is just kind of a thank you to our own staff who work together with our communications team and our counseling resources to keep members and employers notified as to what was going on in their accounts. We had frequent updates on our division webpage. We sent letters to employers and employees so they understand that they would be made whole. And, of course, Empower, our record keeper, provided the resources to do this quickly. And without their help, I'm not sure we would be returning money. It would have taken us a long time. But Empower deployed resources to this project for us free of charge. And we were able to get everybody caught up and resulted in the $1.3 million that we'll be able to return.
All right. Representative Hannon, then Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Ms. Lee, how were communications to the impacted employees made? And secondly, if they asked to see how did Empower calculate that I got 25 cents or I got $3,000 or I got the various amounts. Mm-hmm. How were those calculations done, and were employees able to challenge it if they thought that was inaccurate?
Yes, employees, through the chair, Representative Hannon, employees were notified that if they did not agree with the amounts they saw, they could challenge the amount. And upon request, Empower would provide the actual calculation that came from the Federal Department of Labor calculator for them. That was sent to members by letter and also repeated on our website.
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So was the initial notification to employees that this was happening by letter, and was it only done by letter, or were there other communications to employees that their contributions weren't accruing to their accounts, because the Empower statements don't come monthly. Mm-hmm. And unless someone was checking their digital portal, it might be a whole quarter before they knew that there wasn't a contribution made.
Ms. Lee.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, if I'm not getting this right, I'll invite CFO Novell to jump in. But I believe the initial couple notifications were given to employers, and employers were requested to pass this information on to all of their employees that were participating in the plans.
How'd she do, Mr. Novell?
So through the chair to Representative Hannan, this was also published on our DRB website, along with the letter to the employers.
Follow-up for Mr. Novell, who's made the last comment.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Joseph. I guess putting it on your website requires that a beneficiary was looking at the website for some reason. And, of course, many of our employees are on autopilot. This is something that's done at payroll, and they're just quarterly seeing, yes, my Empower account is growing. And so I am looking to see whether it was just a piece of mail that was sent or if that was the only thing and you said to the school district or the municipality, you're to inform your employees, but how they did it was up to them. So if they said in a newsletter in one line, your Empower account may not be growing and no contributions have been made for 6 months, or I guess five. It's a fairly passive, and I guess we've set it up as a system where we expect people to just, the system goes forward, and so unless we're reaching out to them, they're not going to look and see that there's a problem posted on the retirement and benefits webpage. We didn't send certified mail. We didn't.
Any comment or response to Representative Hannan?
Through the chair to Representative Hannan, that's correct. That's what happened. We just communicated with the employers and put the responsibility of them to contact their employees.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. During this period when payments weren't being made, employers notified their employees that this was a problem, were employees still able to go into their portals and make decisions based on where they wanted their contributions to go during that, even though contributions were not happening? And if so, do you know if they were made whole based on where their elections would have been versus where they would have been going prior to? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Bynum. The members still had full access to their accounts to make any changes that they wanted. The correction was made taking into account where their funds were at any particular time. So if they had made a change in between, Empower would have noted that and calculated the amount that was owed up to the point of change and then again from the point of change till we were completed.
Okay. And then a follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Thank you,
Representative Bynum for Ms. Lee.
Through the chair. We obviously know that, well, let me rephrase this. From what I've heard is that historically there's been some challenges with confidence, I think, from employees on how their assets were being managed. This hiccup with how contributions were being made into the Empower system, although made whole, can create a shaky confidence, I guess, from the employees about the system. Has there been any efforts that you're aware of from Empower or employers to better help educate their employees, empower them, as you would say, to make good, wise decisions, and build confidence in the systems that we're currently using for those investments?
Director Lee.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have not had anything official, like an official notice or whatever that has gone to employees, but both our representatives and Empower representatives in discussions with employees, particularly during this time, made sure to stress that this was an anomaly because we have not had an instance like this in the 30-some years I've been working for the division, and that it was caused not by a system failure, but by an attempted intrusion.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I had one follow-up question that's not related.
Okay. Representative Bynum, new question for Director Lee.
New question.
Okay.
So thank you for the presentation today. Lots of good information here. I know that I'm very interested as we move forward through our budgeting process to talk a little bit about the health of our employees as far as retention goes and when employees are leaving and why that's happening. And I'm assuming that today is not the time for that, but that we will have the opportunity to have those discussions. Am I accurate in that assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the division to give you some information regarding why people are leaving, why we're not retaining them, would be the Division of Personnel as they conduct exit surveys with departing state employees, which represent over half of the members in the system. We have no idea why somebody is leaving or why they want to make a disbursement. We only know that they do.
Okay. Question for the co-chair, if that's okay.
Yeah, we did have Division of Personnel very recently, yep. But go ahead.
And sure. I would hope, Co-Chair Josephson, yep. With the concerns that we have with vacancies and also with recruitment, we talked a little bit about the compensation and pay study yesterday, that we would have an opportunity in the future to dig a little bit more into that and specifically have a focus. I think it's really important for the health of our employees and the services that we provide, that is something that we have a better understanding of. So thank you.
I absolutely share that concern, and you raised it eloquently yesterday. It's calendar sensitive is the only issue. But I will ask my staff to take note of that request. That's my second take note today. So that concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 4th, 2026 at 1:30. At that meeting, the Office of Management and Budget will present amendments to FY26 Governor's Supplemental Items that we heard, I think, early last week. Following that, the Department of Education and Early Development will present its own FY27 budget overview. With that, we will adjourn today's meeting at 3:05. Thank you.
Thank you.